Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the show. It is Friday, December the 4th, and I am Richard Martin, and you are listening to the Wake Up Call, coming to you all the way from Malaysia. Well, you may or may not have wondered why I have never, not once, offered a critical appraisal of President Barack Obama on any show since he came to power in 2009. He was the kind of person that my years of existence on planet Earth have warned me to be cautious about judging. The easygoing demeanor, the sympathy that I always felt for him as a man with very limited ability to govern effectively, all these things and more stayed my hand in ultimate criticism of him. And any potential ulterior motives that he may have harbored, I always felt that he was severely handicapped by being black, beset by a sort of permanent undercurrent of patronizingly indulgent civil servants to whom he was inevitably beholden by dint of returning the favor. Since he became a lame duck president, however, absolutely no longer beholden to anybody for anything, my condemnation of him has rapidly soared in my own estimation of him. I realize that those who had harbored deep resentments since the early days and before were absolutely right. They had hit the nail fairly and squarely on the head. I am sorry it has taken me so long to form my ultimate judgment of this man, and I regret that my powers of analysis were not up to the job. There were plenty of items of evidence that he was not as he seemed, but as you all know, I stay well away from politics just because I do not want to get caught up in the day-to-day yammerings of men with oversized egos. So I overlooked what was, frankly, staring me in the face. Let me, however, no longer prevaricate. I have to set the record straight, and I shall proceed to do so. Beneath progressive pretensions, Barack Obama, the national political phenomenon, has never been anything other than a tool of the United States corporate and financial ruling class. Obama rose to power in Washington with remarkable record-setting financial backing from Wall Street and K Street election investors. Those elites are not in the business of promoting or tolerating politicians who seek to challenge the nation's dominant domestic and imperial hierarchies and doctrines. As the progressive journalist Ken Silverstein noted in a Harper's Magazine report titled Obama Inc. in the fall of 2006, and I quote, "It's not always clear what Obama's financial backers want, but it seems safe to conclude that his campaign contributors are not interested merely in clean government and political reform, on condition of anonymity. One Washington lobbyist I spoke with was willing to point out the obvious, that big donors would not be helping out Obama if they didn't see him as a player. The lobbyist added, what's the dollar value of a starry-eyed idealist? And the answer to the lobbyist's question came less than 3 years later. Priceless. End of quote. In his book, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, from 2011, The Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Suskind tells a remarkable story from March of 2009. 3 months into Obama's presidency, popular rage at Wall Street was intense, and the leading financial institutions were weak and on the defensive. The nation's financial elite had driven the nation and the world's economy into an epic meltdown in the period since Silverstein's essay was published, and millions knew it. Having written into office partly on a wave of popular anger at the economic power elite's staggering malfeasance, Obama called a meeting of the nation's top 13 financial executives at the White House. The banking titans came into the meeting full of dread, only to leave pleased to learn that the new president was in their camp. For instead of standing up for those who had been harmed most by the crisis, workers, minorities, and the poor, Obama sided unequivocally with those who had caused the meltdown. Quoting Obama, "My administration is the only thing between you and the pitchforks. You guys have an acute public relations problem that's turning into a political problem. And I want to help. I'm not here to go after you. I'm protecting you. I'm going to shield you from congressional and public anger." End of quote. For the banking elite, who had destroyed untold millions of jobs, there was, as Suskind puts it, quote, "nothing to worry about." Whereas Roosevelt had, during the Great Depression, pushed for tough, viciously opposed reforms of Wall Street and famously said, "I welcome their hate," Obama was saying, "How can I help?" End of quote. As one leading banker told Suskind, quote, "the sense of everyone after the meeting was relief. The president had us at a moment of real vulnerability. At that point, he could have ordered us to do just about anything and we would have rolled over. But he didn't. He mostly wanted to help us out, to quell the mob." End of quote. The massive taxpayer bailout of the super fat cats would continue, along with numerous other forms of corporate welfare for the super rich, powerful, and parasitic. This state capitalist largesse was unaccompanied by any serious effort to regulate their conduct, or by any remotely comparable bailout for the millions evicted from their homes and jobs by the not-so-invisible hand of the marketplace. No wonder 95% of national U.S. income gains went to the top 1% during Obama's first term. It was a critical moment. With Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress and an angry, pitchfork-wielding populace at the gates, an actually progressive President Obama could have rallied the populace to push back against the nation's concentrated wealth and power structures by moving ahead aggressively with a number of policies: a stimulus with major public works jobs programs, a real single-payer health insurance reform, the serious disciplining and even breakup or nationalization of the leading financial institutions, massive federal housing assistance and mortgage relief, and passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, which have re-legalized union organizing in the U.S. But no such policy initiatives issued from the White House, which opted instead to give the U.S. populace what William Grider memorably called a blunt lesson about power: who has it and who doesn't. Americans watched Washington rush to rescue the very financial interests that caused the catastrophe. They learnt that government has plenty of money to spend when the right people want it, "Where's my bailout?" became the rueful punchline at lunch counters and construction sites nationwide. Then, to deepen the insult, people watched as establishment forces relaunched their campaign for entitlement reform, a euphemism for whacking Social Security benefits, Medicare and Medicaid. Americans also watched as Obama moved on to pass a health insurance reform, the so-called Affordable Care Act, that only the big insurance and drug companies could love, kicking the popular alternative, single-payer Medicare for all, to the curb, while rushing to pass a program drafted by the Republican Heritage Foundation and first carried out in Massachusetts by the arch one percenter Mitt Romney. As Obama later explained to some of his rich friends at an event called the Wall Street Journal CEO Council, a month after trouncing Romney's bid to unseat him, quote, "When you go to other countries, the political divisions are so much more stark and wider. Here in America, the difference between Democrats and Republicans, we're fighting inside the 40-yard lines. People call me a socialist sometimes, but no, you've got to meet real socialists." Laughter. "You'll have a sense of what a socialist is." Laughter. "I'm talking about lowering the corporate tax rate. My healthcare reform is based on the private marketplace." End of quote. He might have added that his healthcare reform was dreamed up by Republicans, consistent with some of his elite supporters, likening of the Obama White House to the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. A year and a half before this tender ruling class moment, the people of America watched Obama offer the Republicans bigger cuts in Social Security and Medicare than they asked for as part of his grand bargain offered during the elite manufactured debt ceiling crisis. It was at that point that hundreds of thousands of mostly younger Americans had received enough of Obama's blunt session about power to join the Occupy Wall Street movement, which sought progressive change through direct action and social movement building rather than corporate captive electoral politics. We will never know how far Occupy might have gone, since it was shut down by a federally coordinated campaign of repression that joined the Obama administration and hundreds of mostly Democratic city governments in the infiltration, surveillance, smearing, takedown and eviction of the short-lived movement. This even as the Democrats stole some of Occupy's rhetoric for use against Romney and the Republicans in 2012. Liberal intellectuals who have claimed to be surprised and disappointed by Obama's corporatist record have either been disingenuous pretenders or bamboozled fools. Obama's allegiance to the American business elite was evident from the get-go. It was well understood by the K Street insiders that Silverstein interviewed in the fall of 2006. It was grasped by the liberal journalist and New Yorker writer Larissa McFarker in the spring of 2007. Quote, "In his view of history, in his respect for tradition, in his skepticism that the world can be changed anyway, but very, very slowly." End of quote. That was what McFarger wrote after extensive interviews with candidate Obama in May of 2007. Quote, "Obama is deeply conservative. There are moments when he sounds almost Burkean. It's not just that he thinks revolutions are unlikely. He values continuity and stability for their own sake, sometimes even more than he values change for the good." End of quote. McFarquhar cited as an example of this reactionary sentiment Obama's reluctance to embrace single-payer health insurance on the Canadian model, which, he told her, would be, quote, so disruptive that people feel like suddenly what they've known for most of their lives is thrown by the wayside. We've got all these legacy systems in place, and managing the transition as well as adjusting the culture to a different system would be difficult to pull off. So we may need a system that's not so disruptive that people feel like suddenly what they've known for most of their lives is thrown by the wayside. End of quote. So what if larger popular majorities in the US had long favoured the single-payer model? So what if single-payer would let people keep the doctors of their choice, only throwing away the protection payoff to the private insurance mafia? So what if the legacy systems Obama defended included corporate insurance and pharmaceutical oligopolies that regularly threw millions of Americans' lives by the wayside of market calculation, causing enormous disruptive harm and death for the populace? This was the slick and slimy, unnamed Obama, granted undue progressive credibility thanks in part to the simple colour of his skin. That the black political scientist Adolf Reed Jr. warned people about in The Village Voice at the beginning of the future president's political career in the Illinois State Senate in January of 1996. Quote, in Chicago, for instance, we've gotten a foretaste of the new breed of foundation-hatched black communitarian voices. One of them, a smooth Harvard lawyer with impeccable do-good credentials and vacuous to repressive neoliberal politics, has won a state Senate seat on a base mainly in the liberal foundation and development worlds. His fundamentally bootstrap line was softened by a patina of the rhetoric of authentic community. Talk about meeting in kitchens, small-scale solutions to social problems, and the predictable elevation of process over program, the point where identity politics converges with old-fashioned middle-class reform in favoring form over substance. I suspect that his ilk is the wave of the future in U.S. black politics, as in Haiti and wherever else the International Monetary Fund has sway. End of quote. It is true that Illinois State Senator Obama publicly embraced single-payer health care insurance, speaking before the Illinois AFL-CIO in late June of 2003. But he didn't really mean it. It was just fake progressive rhetoric related to his upcoming campaign for an open U.S. Senate seat in Illinois, pronounced before he realized that he had a serious near-term shot at the U.S. presidency, something that became clear only in the summer of 2004, an ambition that required the jettisoning of such policy commitments in pursuit of Wall Street backing. 5 years later, candidate Obama's top economic advisor, the neoliberal University of Chicago economist Austin Goolsbee, told Canada's ambassador to the U.S. to disregard Obama's populist-pleasing criticisms of the corporate North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. The criticisms were just campaign oratory geared to winning working-class votes in the Midwest Rust Belt, Goolsbee told the Canadian diplomat. As Goolsbee explained, Obama was just saying the populist-sounding stuff Democratic presidential candidates have to declare in order to get nominated and elected. His anti-NAFTA language, it was not to be taken seriously as a threat to the corporate globalization agenda that US and Canadian elites and Barack Obama shared. Which brings us to Barack Obama's ongoing campaign to win congressional approval for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, a classically neoliberal so-called free trade agreement that has been under secret construction by multinational corporate lawyers and corporate government officials for at least a decade. The measure has taken on what New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker calls, quote, special meaning for a president eager to change the world. It is a way to leave behind a positive legacy abroad, one that could be measured, Obama hopes, by the number of lives improved rather than, as his, with his military actions in the Middle East, by the number of bodies left behind. End of quote. The TPP would join the United States along with 11 other nations along the Pacific Rim, including Canada, Mexico, Japan, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Australia, in a free trade zone covering nearly 40% of the world's economy. The first black Eisenhower Republican president is allied with congressional Republicans and big business groups in claiming that the TPP will open up foreign markets to American goods and, quote-unquote, level the playing field by forcing Asian competitors to improve labor and environmental standards. Labor unions, environmental groups, food safety activists, civil libertarians, civil rights groups, and a good number of congressional Democrats know that's all manipulative business propaganda. The measure isn't really about trade or improved standards. They are quite aware. As the liberal economist Paul Krugman has noticed, whatever benefits may or may not befall the US economy from free trade between the TPP's projected signatory nations have already been realized. The real thrust and significance of the TPP is about strengthening corporations' ability to protect and extend their intellectual property rights, drug patents, movie rights, and the like, and to guarantee that they will be compensated by governments for any profits they might lose from having to meet decent public labor and environmental and other standards, something certain to discourage the enactment and enforcement of such standards. The progressive economist Dean Baker explained things well last December, and I quote, TPP and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Pact, TTIP, are about getting special deals for businesses that they would have difficulty getting through the normal political process. For example, oil and gas companies that think they should be able to drill everywhere may be able to get rules that prevent national or state governments from restricting their activities. This could mean, for example, that New York State would have to compensate potential frackers for the ban that the governor imposed the other day. Similarly, the financial industry will be looking to roll back the sort of regulations put in place through Dodd-Frank and similar legislation in other countries. Again, if governments want to ensure that their financial system is safe, they may have to pay the banks for the privilege. The pharmaceutical industry and entertainment industries will get longer and stronger patent and copyright protection. And the food and pesticide industries will be able to limit the ability of governments to impose safety and environmental regulations. Best of all, these trade deals will set up a new legal structure that goes outside the existing system in the United States and elsewhere. All the businesses that didn't think German or British courts could be trusted to give them a fair deal can turn to the investor state dispute settlement tribunals established as part of these trade pacts. These tribunals will effectively make their own law. The trade deals allow no appeal back to US courts or the courts of any other country that is included. In short, these trade deals are a real bonanza for business. End of quote. No wonder Obama has done everything he can to keep the details of the TPP and TTIP under wraps. When you realize that the TPP would, quote-unquote, affect the lives of millions of Americans, their jobs, their quality of life, as Diana Johnston recently noted in Counterpunch, the secrecy is astounding. U.S. congresspersons and some of their staff can see the TPP's text, or could see the TPP's text, if only they agreed not to take notes or discuss the details in public. Since then, in the last couple of weeks, the whole agreement has been made public, courtesy of New Zealand. I don't know who they got permission from, but hey, up the New Zealanders, I say. The U.S., by the way, it's no wonder that Obama wants Congress to give him fast-track authority to force a yay or nay congressional vote on the TPP with no time for careful consideration and no chance for revisions. Under the fast-track rules, there's no chance for delays or alterations. The pact must be voted up or down and in a very short time frame. Quoting Baker, the idea is that the bulk of the business community promising large campaign contributions to supporters and threatening to punish opponents, most members of Congress would find it very difficult to vote no. End of quote. As the sage left liberal commentator William Grider noted, and I quote, lots of people in the Democratic Party warned Obama that he was heading into a buzzsaw with his Trade-Pacific partnership. He ignored them. Even worse, he got a little nasty with those resisting his proposal, leading voices like Senator Elizabeth Warren. Surrounded by advisers from Citigroup and Goldman Sachs, he scolded Labour. End of quote. Peter DeFazio, an Oregon Democrat, was deeply insulted. Quote, he's ignored Congress and disrespected Congress for years, and then comes to the caucus and lectures us for 40 minutes about his values and whether or not we're being honest by using legislative tactics to try and stop something which we believe is a horrible mistake for the United States of America. And he questions our integrity. It wasn't the greatest strategy. End of quote. Obama and his big business and congressional Republican allies are coming back for a second try. One thing you can count on, the campaign finance money spigot that flows from the corporate class to the nation's not-so-democratically elected officials is fixed in the on position. If anyone cares, a recent CBS New York Times poll finds that, quote, Americans are skeptical of so-called free trade. Nearly two-thirds, that's 63%, favored some form of trade restrictions, and more than half opposed giving the president fast-track authority to negotiate trade agreements that Congress could only vote up or down without amendments. End of quote. Washington runs on corporate campaign cash, not public opinion. It is true. Still, this might be one of those rare moments when something approximating democracy prevails in the nation's dollar-drenched government. As the incisive Georgetown University labor historian Joseph McCartin, himself a one-time Obama enthusiast, told The Guardian, quote, this is the first time Congress considered a trade deal since we as a country became much more cognizant of surging inequality and the crisis in middle-class jobs. The old playbook of the president being able to get the votes at the last minute doesn't seem to apply anymore. End of quote. Whether the Eisenhower Republican in the White House, properly identified nearly two decades ago as a vacuous to repressive neoliberal, and his corporate allies can still salvage a deal is anyone's guess. Whatever occurs, I'm afraid I must concur with the left economist Robert Urey a few weeks ago on Counterpunch, and I quote, "As of the moment of this writing, the certainty surrounding passage of fast-track authority is waning. What has been unleashed by the push to pass the TPP is impetus towards completion of the capitalist corporate coup begun in the 1970s. Investor-state dispute settlement-like mechanisms, shadowy institutions that write global trade rules in accord with corporate interests, exist from past trade agreements and are already being used. Growing catastrophes for global labour and the environment will be at best incrementally inconvenienced by a political setback for fast track. And while ending fast track is a possibly necessary diversion, the capitalist coup and its institutional facts will remain the problem. The next president from either political party will push the same high capitalist program and hide the grab for increased corporate power, not reverse it." End of quote. That's the depressing reality of the world capitalist system. In the short term, however, let us appreciate the final crumbling of the myth of a progressive Barack Obama phenomenon and presidency. The myth is perishing in the icy waters of neoliberal calculation, kind of like the Wicked Witch of the West who screamed, "I'm melting, I'm melting," as Dorothy doused her with a bucket of water near the end of The Wizard of Oz. What a pathetic but predictable finish for Obama, a president elected in the name of progressive hope and change, seeking to leave behind a positive legacy by pushing a noxiously authoritarian and ecocidal free trade measure on behalf of the nation's unelected dictatorship of money over and against public opinion and the common good. The sooner Obama breaks the ribbon on his presidential library to be suitably housed at the arch neoliberal University of Chicago, the better. In the meantime, I would just like one former Progressive for Obama member to offer a formal apology for the abject foolishness they exhibited in support of this deeply conservative corporatist Democrat, and for the venom with which so many liberals attacked those on the actual left who tried to warn US progressives and the world about the cold corporate and imperial reality of Obama Inc. from the start. Now, of course, the magic wand of fake populist candidate deception has been passed on to the militant liberal, neoliberal corporatist Hillary Clinton. In November of 2012, as Secretary of State, she said that the TPP, quote, "sets the gold standard in trade agreements to open free, transparent, fair trade." Let me repeat that. She said that the TPP sets the gold standard in trade agreements to open free, transparent, fair trade. She has, in fact, supported it publicly on 45 different occasions. Currently, however, she is compelled by the dictates of the quadrennial campaign season to pretend to be sceptical about the authoritarian measure. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, she has denied that she is interested in pushing it any longer. No doubt, leftists who protest when she moves forward on the high capitalist program as US president will be absurdly denounced as sexists by many of her liberal defenders, just as Obama's left critics have been falsely called racists by many of his liberal fans. Such are the sinister uses of identity politics for the globalist bourgeoisie. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Again, I am sorry this story took so long to tell. All I can say in my defence is that I never actually supported Obama against the crowd, so my faithful listeners were at the very worst left hanging in the absence of commentary about this man. Interestingly enough, I have never received a single question about my attitudes towards Obama. I'm truly not sure what I would have said if I had. I suppose it was a question of giving him the benefit of the doubt. So you see, despite my strongly held views on so many things, I really do make an effort to be fair, so that when I have something to say about anything, you can know that it is truly felt, and that I have absolutely no axe to grind.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, in Chicago, there was a shooting of Laquan McDonald over a year ago. 400 days later, there was a murder charge leveled in that shooting, even though the shooting itself was caught on videotape and the tape was known to exist and was in the custody of police within hours. That's because the recording was made on a cop dash cam. The dead guy was 17, had a 3-inch pocket knife, and was on drugs. The drugs part, of course, was only known posthumously. However, he wasn't attacking anyone with the knife. The blade was folded into the handle and thus not capable of stabbing anyone. And in fact, he never made a move in that direction of the officers with the folded knife. Threats with open knives are certainly acts that, for anyone who knows anything about knives, at reasonable distance are certainly reason to shoot. You can close the distance in a shockingly short period of time, and even a 3-inch knife is more than enough to kill. Knives are bad news, and in many ways can be worse than guns. But in this case, the deceased didn't have an open blade, and more importantly, he was walking away. The cop who shot him took an entire 6 seconds after exiting his car and fired the first rounds from 15 feet. Then he kept shooting after the teen was hit and had fallen to the ground, emptying his weapon. Of the officers there, including his partner, he was the only one to fire. The police department appears to have tried to cover it up, as did the city. For 400 days they tried. There is evidence that the city and cops attempted not only to prevent release of the footage of what looks a lot like an execution, they also tampered with security camera footage from at least one nearby business. The media is not only complicit, they're outright in on it, with pieces that say things like this, and I quote unquote, "The majority of police officers are incredible men and women who suit up every day to protect and serve their communities." By waiting 400 days to charge Van Dyke as he collected a paycheck, it looks like the city is not only protecting Van Dyke, it is dragging its feet on justice. Oh no, they're not. Every single one of the Chicago police officers from the beat con on up, who knew of tampered evidence and said nothing, are accessories after the fact to this apparent crime. Yet none will be charged. Every single one of them, were they to be an ordinary civilian, would be facing felony charges right here and now. Were you or I to shoot someone in circumstances similar to this cop, it wouldn't take 400 seconds before we were charged, rather than 400 days. The city and its government knew damn well how bad this was up front, as evidenced by the fact that they paid off the family long before charges were laid. They didn't have to wait to be sued. They knew they'd lose, so they forked up the citizens' cash before they'd ever hit a courtroom. The city government, hello, Rahm Emanuel, robbed the citizens to pay for the crime committed by the entire Chicago PD. Everyone, of course, wants to make this about race. It's not about race. It's about murder and then paying people off with someone else's money that is forcibly taken from them, in this case, forcibly taken from the people who live in Chicago. That adds theft to the litany of abuses, all under the general category of corruption, abuse of power, and direct violations of your rights. But nobody cares about where the real issues lie, nor will they do anything about it. Oh, sure, there are protests both past and planned, including threatened protests to try to disrupt Black Friday on the Miracle Mile. The latter, by the way, is not only good, it's about time, because the people who butter the bread in the city are the businesses that pay exorbitant rents and taxes. And if you can't get someone's attention by appealing to common sense, try economic pressure. It often works. After all, it's far more likely that a merchant paying millions in taxes will get the attention of the corrupt city when their income is cut off than you will by waving a sign. This, of course, is not the first, nor will it be the last, of these adventures by your cities, states, and federal government. It just happens to be a particularly egregious example that the city is trying to cover up by hitting the cop with a murder charge, but only one cop, rather than everyone involved in what is obviously rank obstruction of justice and evidence tampering, all of which are felonies. When are we going to stop this crap as a society? It's not just the murder of a 17-year-old, an act that many will excuse because he was high. So what if he was high? Yes, I know, there are claims he was burgling vehicles, but that's not cause to execute him, it's cause to arrest him. There was quite clearly no attempt to arrest made here, but more importantly, what is evident is that the entire apparatus of government tried to cover it up, including paying off the family. The same outrage is happening all over the country and has been for decades. 9/11, anyone? Nobody ever faced the music for their failures, yet those attacks were utterly preventable even without any of the modern surveillance state. The FBI had multiple reports on those who committed the attacks and yet did nothing. You have a former governor running for president whose administration gave driver licenses, that is, valid state IDs, to the majority of the hijackers, despite them not being either citizens or permanent legal residents. Those two acts alone were overwhelmingly enabling factors in the deaths of 3,000 Americans. Were you or I to commit any of those acts as ordinary citizens, we would have been charged as accessories before the fact to 3,000 acts of murder and death by terrorism. Yet Jeb and the Fibbies involved not only walked free, the former is running for president. Hillary Clinton undertook a blatantly unlawful set of actions while Secretary of State with her email server. She knew it was illegal, as she was well aware of the requirements to maintain not only all correspondence in relationship to her job as a government employee, but also the fact that much of what she did was inherently classified. Civilians and members of the armed forces and government agencies comply with these laws every single day, including those who work for various branches. They comply because it's the right thing to do, and in addition, it's legally required. Clinton did not comply because she believed, rightly so thus far, that that she was above the law and could do whatever she wanted, including quite possibly actively getting people killed in Benghazi. It is known that she directly lied to the American people about the cause of that attack, because she told her daughter what the true cause was within hours, and it had nothing to do with an internet video. One of the reasons for public records laws is to expose such lies. And one of the reasons Clinton did what she did was to try to prevent that exposure. This alone ought to disqualify her from running for president. Yet nearly half the nation is prepared to vote for her anyway. Well, I simply had to read you this article from Melissa Zersis, a real estate agent who came through the last housing bubble scathed and is determined not to have to undergo a repeat performance. It is an insider's view and thus quite revealing. It's worth your time. So listen up and here goes. On the surface, the housing market in Washington, D.C. is moving along at a good clip, though there are indications it's not as active as it was earlier in the year or last year. Despite the free money party, we all assume rates are eventually going to rise. When I ask lenders what's different now, they say that property values aren't being artificially inflated by appraisers like they were. There are no more no-doc interest, only no-money-down loan programs. Buyers actually have to have skin in the game. Fair enough, but that's just the part about qualifying and getting someone into a house. What about keeping them there through a downturn? What if home prices soften when interest rates go up? Will those once well-qualified people stay in their homes, even if these homes are no longer worth what buyers paid for them? If buyers put 10% down and their homes drop 20 or 30% in value, will they walk away or wait it out? The thought of a downturn is terrifying, but markets ebb and flow. The manipulation of interest rates in an attempt to prevent normal market corrections from happening was fine for a while, but this just feels excessive. When buyers are bidding up the price of every single house as a rule, then money is just too easy to get. When buyers have to waive home inspection along with appraisal and financing contingencies to get a house that, in a more balanced market, would never garner such attention, I'm suspicious. When someone outbid my client and several others to pay $1 million for a house listed at $850,000, a house that had only one bathroom, something is just not right. But there's something even more concerning. Venture capital firms are out there dumping millions into all sorts of real estate companies. Why would investors throw money at a regular real estate brokerage, doing nothing different than the typical brokerage, which is hire agents, keep a percentage of their commission, and pay them the rest? It's reminiscent of the late 90s tech boom, when venture capital money was dumped into companies that lacked a discernible business plan, excuse me, other than that they were something tech. Real estate brokerages are not an exceptionally profitable business, no matter how high-producing the agents are who work there. Top agents make 90% of their commission in the split. So a brokerage only gets to keep 10% of the money that comes in the door. Then it has to spend on signing bonuses, overhead in the form of luxury offices, and salaried staff needed to entice those top agents. How can this be a profitable investment for a venture capital firm? This is the usual progression of everything good in business. The people in it ride the wave up. then people on the outside see money being made and they jump in too. And that's when it all falls apart, when the predators arrive. Are people so real estate crazy that they can't see how insane this has become? I remember 2007 all too well. I was doing a job I loved, working for a builder I loved, when all of a sudden people stopped showing up at our gorgeous model homes and writing contracts on the spot. Buyers turned from desperate to fickle. They would blow off appointments and not contact the lender. They realized the tide was turning back in their favor. Our company was hiring people right up to the day it instituted layoffs. Same old story. People never think the party will end, but it always does. My observations lack hard numbers, but I'm out on the street, not in an office crunching numbers. I see what goes on down here, and it isn't always pretty. I hear what people's fears and hopes are. I am getting the consumer sentiment firsthand from my clients. That, to me, is better than any indicator backed by a statistic, especially when you hear and see the same things from multiple clients. So what will keep this market moving? Sellers need to stop pricing with obscene increases from what the comparable sales show. Buyers want to lock in before rates go up, but they shouldn't be willing to overpay. There's more property sitting on the market in DC than there has been in the last few years. I had a great listing priced right at market value this fall, supported by recent comparable sales, and it took, gasp, 3 weeks to go under contract. I have clients who I just told a couple of weeks ago not to buy a condo they were prepared to make an offer on. The price was just too high. They found something better for $130,000 less. I love my job and this industry, but I can't take responsibility for every single home buyer out there, just the ones I'm advising. If the bottom falls out of the housing market again, will the lenders get blamed like last time? Will the real estate agent get blamed like last time? Or will the people who overpaid for these properties act like adults and take responsibility for their decisions and recognize that no one forced their hand? I can say one thing. I have changed my approach to doing business. I'm no longer leaving the decisions solely to my clients. I used to present them with the information and their options and let them decide. Now, I still present the information and options, but before they have a chance to make a foolish decision, I tell them what not to do. Don't buy this house. It sounds ridiculous when I'm saying it, but I don't want any of my clients left holding the bag if the bottom blows out of this thing. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, one of its biggest new housing construction booms in history is maturing, just as the tsunami of money from the startup boom begins to recede, with consequences. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Very interesting. A message of honesty and sincerity from an unexpected source, I would say. Well, just a few statistics to finish up with on this glorious Friday afternoon. 45% of Americans now say they have a negative view of the Affordable Care Act, while 38% have a positive view. This represents a reversal from earlier this year when, for the first time in 3 years, a greater number of Americans were in favor of the law than against it. Americans also stand divided on what they want to see done with the law. 30% want Congress to repeal the law. 12% would prefer them just to scale back on how much power the law has. 16% want it to remain as is, and 26% want Congress to expand it. Well, European banks are sitting on bad debts of 1 trillion euros, the equivalent of the GDP of Spain, which is holding back their profitability and ability to lend to high street customers and businesses. According to a detailed analysis of 105 banks across 21 countries in the European Union conducted by the European Banking Authority, the experience of Europe's banks to troubled customers is worse than that of their counterparts in the US. The 1 trillion euro, which is about 706 billion pounds, of so-called non-performing loans amount to almost 6% of the total loans and advances of Europe's banks, and 10% when lending to other financial institutions are excluded. The equivalent figure for the US banking industry is around 3%. Well, have you seen the pathetically frantic poaching of retailers these days? The tsunami of web, email, print and mail adverts are reeking of desperation. A desperation to snag the few dollars consumers are willing to spend this holiday season before some competing retailer entices the tight-fisted consumer first. There's a noticeable weariness in the air this shopping season that we've noticed in the last few days, bordering on retail mania exhaustion. Even Black Friday has been drained of shopaholic excitement by pre-sales and pre-pre-sales. It's now essentially impossible to parody the absurdity and excess of Christmas in America. Can't live without the $800 fake Christmas tree made in China for the Martha Stewart brand? I suspect that a great many people are realizing that they, one, can in fact live quite well without the absurd excess of credit card funded spending, or two, they can't afford the absurd excess of credit card funded spending. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that's it. That's it for the show today, and as always, I wish you a wonderful weekend ahead, and I will be back, as always, on Monday with another edition of the Wake Up Call, and this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.
And there you have it. You decide.